We completed our study of chapter 9 last week, where he was giving us that description of those last few verses, 30 through 37, with the death of Jezebel, that wife of Ahab, and all of these things that we saw in 2 Kings chapter 9 were fulfillment of plans that God had made and prophecies that he had made going back to the time of Elijah the prophet, including prophecies of that Jehu, the son of Nimshi, would be the next king of Israel, and that he would be anointed as such, and then he would be the instrument in the Lord's hands to carry out God's judgments on the house of Ahab. And in those particular prophecies that were about Ahab's house, we saw those going back into the book of 1 Kings, especially in chapter 21, when Naboth, his vineyard was taken by Ahab and Jezebel, and he and his family were murdered, and the Lord made several prophecies against the house of Ahab, including its utter destruction, but also concerning Ahab himself, where that his blood would be licked up by the dogs in that very place where Naboth's blood had been shed, that Jezebel would be, her blood would be splattered there on the wall there in Jezreel. All of that happened, of course, as God had proclaimed. We even found mention of a prophecy that was fulfilled that Jehu spoke of that we did not have the record of prior to that, but that was when Jehoram, Ahab's son, who was king of Israel, the northern kingdom, when he was killed by Jehu and his body was cast there in that portion of ground that had been Naboth's, and that also was fulfilling what God had proclaimed in prophecy as judgment upon Ahab, who had had not only Naboth, but his family, his sons, killed so that he could dispossess him of his inheritance and take that vineyard for himself. And so all of that was fulfilled by Jehu, and that's what brought us to the end of 2 Kings chapter 9. And so there's going to be more of the judgments against the house of Ahab that are going to be described for us and brought to pass in chapter 10. And so there's a lot more of Ahab's family. In fact, really all of his family except for Ahab himself and now Jezebel, his son Ahaziah, who had been king before Jehoram, and then Jehoram himself. So Ahab, Jezebel, and two of their sons, and then the grandson Ahaziah that was king of Judah, they're the only ones that have fallen now. So what about the rest of the family? Well, God had pronounced utter destruction on all of them. So that is going to take place now in chapter 10. So the beginning of chapter 10 then tells us about these 70 sons of Ahab, and they're going to meet their end here in this 10th chapter of the book of 2 Kings. So we want to go there now and start reading here in verse 1 in 2 Kings 10. It says, "And Ahab had 70 sons in Samaria, and Jehu wrote letters and sent to Samaria unto the rulers of Jezreel, to the elders, and to them that brought up Ahab's children, saying, Now as soon as this letter cometh to you, seeing your master's sons are with you, and there are with you chariots and horses, a fenced city also, and armor, look even out the best and meetest of your master's sons, and set him on his father's throne, and fight for your master's house. But they were exceedingly afraid, and said, Behold, two kings stood not before him. How then shall we stand? There's some wise thinking on their part, recognizing that if they go up and now try to fight against Jehu, who is a very experienced warrior. Of course, most importantly, it's God that's behind him in this. But they recognized that two kings had already fallen. How well are they likely to succeed in a fight against Jehu right now? Well, they're not seeing their chances as being very good. This is somewhat along the lines of the calculation that the Gibeonites made in the book of Joshua after Jericho had fallen and then Ai. Well, they could see that they were next as far as the closest in proximity to where the Israelite army was under Joshua. And with those cities having fallen and being utterly destroyed, they reasoned that it was not going to be to their benefit to have a fight with Joshua. And of course, that's when they came up with their plan to go into disguise and to deceive them into making a covenant with them so they would be spared, even though that covenant, they agreed they would be essentially the slaves of Israel, but they considered that better than being dead. So that's what happened back then. Well, I mean, there are times like this where certain ones can see that. Now, how many times do we see people that are blinded and very foolish, and their decisions and judgment are not sound or wise at all in matters like this? Well, there's been several examples of that that we know of, and there were many of the Canaanites. In fact, all the rest of the Canaanites, other than Gibeon, continued to try to fight with Joshua, and they all were defeated. But that was of God, and that was his will. But so is it God's plan and his will that the house of Ahab fall at the hands of Jehu here. But Jehu is, since there, this is the place there in Samaria. I mean, this is the capital city. This is where the king's palace is. This is the capital of the kingdom. So as far as cities that would be in terms of being well defended, having garrisons of troops, but of course all the army is under Jehu's command. But as far as any of the guard for the king or any troops that might be particularly tasked with protecting the royal household, as there would be, I mean, where are you going to find a stronger defensive position than in Samaria itself? I mean, this would be really it for all of the kingdom. So that's where Ahab's sons are. And so they sent to Samaria and to the rulers of Jezreel, which of course is next door. Now that also reminds us, as far as these elders there from Jezreel, from what we've seen of them, how principled are they? Well, if the principle is doing what's going to protect themselves, they're very principled. But as far as anything else, we don't really see that, do we? Remember back in 2 Kings chapter 21, Jezebel's, for her plan that she came up with to have Naboth killed involved those elders of Jezreel, where they paid those ones of Belial to make a false accusation against Naboth that he had blasphemed God and the king, and that would be the justification, that false witness, that lie, for Naboth then to be murdered. But that had to be with the knowledge of these elders of Jezreel. They had to go along with that plan. Well, when they were presented with that plan, and they didn't say a word against it, they didn't do a thing to stop it. Well, what would be the reason? Well, if they then had resisted Jezebel, I mean, what would have happened to them? they'd have been dead. So they were willingly went along with the murder of an innocent man to protect their own lives. Here they are now with Jehu coming after them, saying, "Okay, you've got Ahab's sons there. So that's where, if the house of Ahab is going to continue to rule over Israel, then one of these remaining sons would need to be chosen to be the next king, which would then require a fight with Jehu for the kingdom. So here it is. It's time to do that. Anoint one of them and come out and fight." So they understand, though, that that's going to be a fight that they're going to lose. So here again, they're in a position of, well, are they going to stand for the house of Ahab and risk their own lives, or are they going to take the way out that's going to enable them to survive? And that's what they go with again. So they are going to give up Ahab's, all of his family. They're not going to try to anoint one of them to be king and then fight for him. So they were exceedingly afraid, it said, and their reasoning was that, I mean, two kings, that would be Jehoram and Ahaziah, were unable to stand before Jehu. He'd already killed two kings. Are they going to try to anoint a third to fight and see that happen? Well, no. So it says in verse 5, "And he that was over the house and he that was over the city, the elders also and the bringers up of the children, sent to Jehu, saying, 'We are thy servants and will do all that thou shalt bid us. We will not make any king. Do thou that which is good in thine eyes.' Then he wrote a letter the second time to them, saying, 'If you be mine, and if you will hearken unto my voice, take ye the heads of the men, your master's sons, and come to me to Jezreel by tomorrow this time.' Now the king's sons, being 70 persons, were with the great men of the city, which brought them up." Now here are these ones, I mean, these are ones, as it's describing there, that had known these sons of Ahab from the time of their birth. I mean, this is where they had been raised, and these ones had been actively involved in the raising of these sons of Ahab. So it's not like these were strangers to them. So it was one thing for them to give them up and allow Jehu to do this, to kill them. But now Jehu is tasking them. They're saying, we're your servants, Jehu. Well, if that's so, you do the dirty work. I mean, that's what he's telling them to do. They can prove that they're his servants by beheading them themselves. Now, how difficult would that be? Here they are. These are ones they've brought up, and they're going to have to do that deed. So in verse 7, it says, "It came to pass, when the letter came to them, that they took the king's sons and slew 70 persons and put their heads in baskets and sent them to Jezreel." They did it. So that's how far they were willing to go to protect themselves. So when it came to that, it's them or us. You can see what choice they made. So that would not have been an easy thing that they were given to do there, but they did that. So Jehu was able to have this done without him having to do that himself, and also without having to engage in a battle with Samaria and Jezreel there, where the king's, where his palace was and his people. So in verse 8, it says, "And there came a messenger and told him, saying, 'They have brought the heads of the king's sons.' And he said, 'Lay them in two heaps at the entering in of the gate until the morning.' And it came to pass in the morning that he went out and stood and said to all the people, 'Ye be righteous. Behold, I conspired against my master and slew him. But who slew all these? Know thou that there shall fall unto the earth nothing of the word of the Lord which the Lord spake concerning the house of Ahab, for the Lord hath done that which he spake by his servant Elijah.'" So he makes a point of that, that he had not personally done that. He had killed those others. he confessed that he had conspired against his master and killed him, but who killed all of his sons? Well, they did. Of course, that was with, well, they didn't have guns there at that time, so it wasn't with a gun to their head, but certainly with a sword to their neck in that sense. He's pointing out that all of this is in fulfillment of God's will, and that nothing that God had spoken about the house of Ahab would fall to the earth. It would all come to pass. It would not one part of it was going to be left unfulfilled. And the Lord, he's giving credit to God for this work, that this was God's judgment and that God had made it come to pass. And he was right on that. When you hear these words and what we saw back in the previous chapter when he spoke of the Lord's prophecies against when Jehoram was killed and his body was cast into the ground there, and then with what happened to Jezebel, and he knew well all of those words that God spoke about what was going to happen to Ahab's family, the specific prophecies and where the things would happen. And he is very plainly stating that this was going to all be fulfilled like God said, and God was doing it. When we read those words, and then you think about Jehu and what we're going to read about his life and his decisions, knowing what he knows here, why would he not serve this one who's doing all of this? When he knows that this is all by God's word and that nothing that God speaks about this would fall to the ground, well, what about everything else that he said? Would anything that God spoke fall to the ground, or was God going to bring to pass everything? Isn't this an acknowledgement that God is the God of heaven, and that he's the one that is ruling, and he's doing everything, and he is the Almighty? I mean, what else do these words mean? And how can he say that and then say, but I'm not going to serve him myself? It's really astounding from that standpoint that he can acknowledge these things about God and his work, but then he doesn't choose to do his will. Now he's choosing to do his will in this particular work, as we've noted, that's going to end up securing the throne for Jehu to reign as king. But I mean, he's going to have a few years to rule as king over Israel. But then what? I mean, how long was that compared to what came afterwards? Where is he now? I mean, what good were those few years of being king over that kingdom in his time, and losing, what was that compared to losing his soul? I mean, what has he got now? I mean, it's really astounding to see that that choice he was making there. But of course, then we see, I mean, how many people make acknowledgments about God and about Christ and things that they believe about God and about his son Jesus Christ. I mean, how many people profess faith in the Lord today, but when it comes down to choosing whether to do his will or not? I mean, there's so many that do that. So this, we're seeing a degree of religion here on the part of Jehu, but what about making the decision that he's going to serve him? So is it sufficient if salvation is by faith only? Well, does Jehu have any faith? I mean, he's got some. I mean, he's acknowledging who Jehovah is and who's doing all of this work. So if that's all it takes, I mean, Jehu's fine, isn't he? But he's not. Because it's not everyone that says, "Lord, Lord," that will enter into the kingdom of heaven, Matthew 7:21. But he that doeth the will of my Father which is in heaven, that's what Jesus said. Well, is Jehu doing the will of the Father who is in heaven, who's doing all this work? God's doing all of his work. Well, is Jehu's work serving God? Only in this. So this is something we can keep in our minds, because we don't want to follow that pattern. And can we? Could we end up being in a pattern in our own lives where we're very religious. We confess who God is and who His Son is and believe these things about His Word and readily acknowledge that and do certain works for Him, but then do not carry it forth to glorify Him as God by doing all of His will and none of our own. Well, we could easily end up in the same situation if we're not careful. So this is a very... Jehu's life is one that should get our attention as a warning that it's not sufficient to go a certain distance in our... have a certain degree of faith or go a certain distance in our service to God and then stop there. That's not going to be acceptable to the Lord. How much of His will do we have to do? How much do we have to serve Him? How much do we have to believe in Him? How much of His must we be? And we do have to go fully all the way with that. And Jesus is our pattern there, who did nothing of Himself, but always what pleased His Father in heaven. And we must do the same. So after acknowledging all of this, verse 11 says, "So Jehu slew all that remained of the house of Ahab in Jezreel, and all his great men and his kinsfolks and his priests, until he left him none remaining." So that's it. I mean, that's what God spoke about the house of Ahab, that he would do with it like he did with the house of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and like he did with the house of Baasha. And that's now happened. And he was going to use Jehu to do it, and it's now been done. So every member of the house of Ahab now is gone. He left him none remaining. And so now the question is Jehu's work done? Well, that part of it is. But he's got some other things to do here. So in verse 12, we can ask the question now, well, what was the problem in Israel that occurred as a result of Ahab marrying Jezebel? What's happened in Israel? Going back even further, what happened after the split in the kingdom? Going back even a step further than that, when was the last time all Israel as a nation was acknowledging God, the God of heaven, Jehovah, who was not just the God of Israel, but the God of heaven? But how long ago was it when Israel was acknowledging that and carrying that through in their action as the nation as a whole being obedient to and following the Lord and keeping his commandments? That would go back to the time of David and Solomon, wouldn't it? And that was the last time they were sitting every man under his vine and under his fig tree. When God blessed them because they were obeying Him. At that point, would recall that the Lord stated that they occupied fully all of the territory in the land of Canaan, with its boundaries from the Great Sea, the Mediterranean Sea, all the way to the river Euphrates, and everything in between, all that God had designated and promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that would be theirs, that first had been fulfilled completely back in the time of Joshua, but through the period of the Judges, where they had the back and forth, the on again, off again with their service to God, and so they would lose territory and be subdued by an enemy, and then they would repent, and a judge would be raised up by God, and their enemy would be defeated, and they would again possess their land. But that went back and forth; that were through a cycle many times through that 400-year period or history of the Judges, and then Saul became king. Of course, Saul did not serve the Lord, but Israel as a nation began its repentance under Samuel, but then it was fulfilled under David, when David, who was a man after God's own heart, served the Lord, and his kingdom did with him, and then that continued in the reign of Solomon until, when did the downfall begin? Well, when Solomon had his heart turned by his wives, those Gentile princesses that he had married, all 700 of them, that turned his heart away from God to their idols. And the people of Israel followed suit. Now, Solomon himself, as we know, ultimately repented of that. And we have the book of Ecclesiastes that contains those words of repentant Solomon with his wisdom in the conclusion of the whole matter, which is to fear God and keep his commandments. That's the whole duty of man. The fact that Solomon repented did everybody else that then became idol worshipers when he did they all repent? No. And that's why we had in 1 Kings 11 that prophecy of the Lord when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, was anointed to be the king over 10 tribes of Israel, or was prophesied in 1 Kings 11 that he would be, and then he was anointed by Israel in the next chapter. But that was because of not just Solomon, but the people of Israel that had turned to idols. So that's when things started to go wrong there. It was in Solomon's later years. And then Israel took up idol worship when Solomon did. But then, since they had done that, well, Solomon repented, but all the people didn't. So then Jeroboam becomes king, and then he makes those two golden calves, one in Dan and one in Bethel, and tells Israel to that they're their gods, and makes up their own priests and feast days, a completely new religion. And for the most part, those 10 tribes in the north, they go right along with it. The ones who wouldn't, that remnant that continued to serve God, what did they do? They left, and they joined themselves to Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and they strengthened his kingdom, well, until he went off. Under Asa and Jehoshaphat, we saw Judah following the Lord. But the northern kingdom of Israel, which was the majority of the nation, 10 of its tribes, followed in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. From that point on, in fact, that's going to continue until all of those tribes are destroyed and put out of existence. They are taken into captivity by the Assyrians, and they just were, whoever lived got assimilated, because as far as spiritually speaking, they were completely of the world anyway, and they just became lost as any distinct followers of the Lord. So those became the lost tribes of Israel permanently, and they never returned. So that was the end of those tribes as far as their existence and identification with Jehovah. But here we are in that situation, but with Ahab and Jezebel, you've got all that going on with the all those sins of Jeroboam still in existence. But then Jezebel turns Israel to worshiping Baal, because that was her religion, and that was the religion of her father, the king of the Zidonians, Ethbaal. So that had brought things to the lowest level spiritually in Israel that had really than that had ever been than had ever been, and so that's still going on. Of course, we know that influence then extended to Judah when Jehoshaphat's son Jehoram married Athaliah, then Ahaziah, their son, who was killed by Jehu at this time. They followed Baal, and then Athaliah is going to make herself queen for 6 years, but in Judah. But you've got this spreading of Baal worship on into Judah also, so it's taken over the nation. Elijah thought he was the only one left that served God, and now the Lord told him in 1 Kings 19 that he still had 6,000 that had not bowed their knees to Baal, but out of the whole nation, is that a lot? That's not a lot. What, you know, in terms of the percentage of the population of Israel, the ones that still, and it wasn't that they were openly following Jehovah, but they had resisted turning to Baal at least, but there weren't many that had refused. There are very few in Israel left that aren't serving Baal. What is an obvious work that needs to be done? Wiping out the house of Ahab, they were worthy of that vengeance and judgment of God. But what needs to happen in Israel? Well, Baal worship needs to be driven out. Of course, the sins of Jeroboam do also. That's not going to happen, and there's going to be the ultimate penalty of the destruction of the nation for it. But Jehu is going to take measures now to rid Israel of the Baal worship that was brought in by Jezebel. So that was identified with Jezebel in that with the house of Ahab. This again raises a question: are Jehu's motives here? Does he have religious motives? Because does he, in recognizing who God is, is it that he recognizes the falsehood of the religion of Baal worship, and that he's committed to having Israel turn to the Lord and away from Baal worship? Well, if that were the case, then we might ask, well, why didn't he go further and get rid of all those sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and the false religion that he had made? If his motives were pure and sincere, why go part way but not all the way? But when he's now wiping out the house of Ahab, he's securing his throne. Is that going to be in his interest to keep the religion, what is now the state religion that's identified with the house that he has just destroyed in order for him to be king? Or is he trying to make a clean break with everything that was of everything to do with Ahab's reign? It's hard to see his motives being entirely pure and sincere. Can the Lord use someone? Does for someone to be a tool used by the Lord in His work? Do they have to be someone that is a true and full believer in the Lord and servant of His in order for God to use them in His work in some way? No, I mean, everything that he allows Satan to do is ultimately going to accomplish whose work? God's. If you need an answer to the question, there it is. Satan obviously is no follower of God, but God uses Satan's own work and turns it to fulfill his own work for his own glory. So he does that with the devil and all the devil's servants, including this one, Jehu. I mean, let's keep in mind, Jehu is a servant of the devil. God is still using him and whatever motives and mixed or impure as they were. God determined to have Ahab's house destroyed. Was it done? It was done. And he used Jehu to do it. And he's going to use Jehu to bring judgment on Baal worship in Israel. Whatever Jehu's motives are in that, God's going to accomplish that that destruction and judgment of Baal worship anyway. So in verse 12, it says, "And he arose and departed and came to Samaria. And as he was at the shearing house in the way, Jehu met with the brethren of Ahaziah, king of Judah, and said, 'Who are ye?' And they answered, 'We are the brethren of Ahaziah, and we go down to salute the children of the king and the children of the queen.' And he said, 'Take them alive.' And he took them alive and slew them at the pit of the shearing house, even 42 men, neither left any of them." Okay, so that's a part. We have some of that that was recorded in 2 Chronicles 22 that we've already gone over and noted. Is this within the bounds of what God authorized him to do, or has he stepped outside of that now to kill these 42 servants of Ahaziah, the king of Judah? This is not part of the work that God gave Jehu to do right here. He's going off on his own right here and doing what he wanted to do. So later, as we know, God brought judgment on Jehu's family for this blood that was shed by Jehu. So what God did to recompense or to judge the blood that was shed by Ahab and Jezebel, he's going to do the same with Jehu. Does Jehu give that any thought? Does he think, well, you know, God is very mindful of every drop of blood that was shed, and look at how he's brought vengeance. But now I can go and shed whatever blood I desire, but that's going to be fine. If he were to stop and think and reason at all, shouldn't that occur to him that what happened to that blood shed by Ahab and during his reign, that any blood that Jehu's going to shed, if he's going to murder people, that God's going to require that of him also? Well, he will, but he does not apparently think about that and how that's going to apply to himself as it had to Ahab, but it will. In verse 15, it says, "And when he was departed thence, he lighted on Jehonadab, the son of Rechab, coming to meet him. And he saluted him and said to him, Is thine heart right as my heart is with thy heart? And Jehonadab answered, It is. If it be, give me thine hand. And he gave him his hand, and he took him up to him into the chariot. And he said, Come with me and see my zeal for the Lord. So they made him ride in his chariot. And when he came to Samaria, he slew all that remained unto Ahab in Samaria till he had destroyed him according to the saying of the Lord which he spake to Elijah. And Jehu gathered all the people together and said unto them, Ahab served Baal a little, but Jehu shall serve him much. Now therefore call unto me all the prophets of Baal, all his servants and all his priests. Let none be wanting, for I have a great sacrifice to do to Baal. Whosoever shall be wanting, he shall not live. But Jehu did it subtly, to the intent that he might destroy the worshippers of Baal. And Jehu said, Proclaim a solemn assembly for Baal. And they proclaimed it. And Jehu sent through all Israel, and all the worshippers of Baal came, so that there was not a man left that came not. And they came into the house of Baal, and the house of Baal was full from one end to another. And he said unto him that was over the vestry, Bring forth vestments for all the worshippers of Baal. And he brought them forth vestments. And Jehu went, and Jehonadab the son of Rechab, into the house of Baal, and said unto the worshippers of Baal, Search and look, that there be here with you none of the servants of the Lord, but the worshippers of Baal only. And they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings. And when they went in to offer sacrifices and burnt offerings, Jehu appointed 40 men without. That means 80 men outside this Baal temple. And said, If any of the men whom I have brought into your hands escape, he that lets him go, his life shall be for the life of him. And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of offering the burnt offering, that Jehu said to the guard and to the captains, Go in and slay them, let none come forth. And they smote them with the edge of the sword. And the guard and the captains cast them out and went to the city of the house of Baal. And they brought forth the images out of the house of Baal and burned them. And they brake down the image of Baal and brake down the house of Baal and made it a draft house unto this day. Thus Jehu destroyed Baal out of Israel. So there is the work that he does in destroying Baal and Baal worship out of Israel. Now, of course, we can see this is certainly God's will to bring this judgment to pass. And again, he uses Jehu to do that. When Jehu says, Come and see my zeal for Jehovah, well, again, we can question, is this so much a zeal for Jehovah himself, or does this fit in with Jehu's, what's going to help him in securing the kingdom for himself? But nevertheless, God still uses whatever his motives are to bring to pass this destruction of Baal worship there in Israel. When he When he's going to do this, though, we can see that he involves this Jehonadab that he is mentioning here in verse 15, who was a son of Rechab. This particular individual that we do not have any other information about in God's word. We do know from the genealogy of the Israelites, we know the background of the family that he came from. Going back to 1 Chronicles chapter 2, if we can go over there just momentarily before we run out of time. In 1 Chronicles chapter 2, in verse 55, it says, and this is without reading all that came, all those names and families that come before this verse, but this is in this 1 Chronicles, those early chapters are giving detailed genealogies of the different tribes of Israel, families within those tribes, and some other important listings, including this. He's not describing here families of the tribes of Israel. He's describing families that were of the Kenites. Verse 55 says, "And the families of the scribes which dwelt at Jabez, the Tirathites, the Shimeathites, and the Sukathites, these are the Kenites that came out of Hemath, the father of the house of Rechab." So these are the Rechabites, so their origin, these are parts, the Rechabites are one of the families of the Kenites. The Kenites were the descendants of Jethro, Moses' father-in-law. So they were not Israelites per se. They were not descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jethro was Moses' father-in-law, and his father-in-law joined himself and his family to Israel. And so they identified with the Israelite nation and became part of the nation, though they were they had a separate genealogy. I mean, they were not of the tribes of Israel, but nevertheless, they became followers of God, and as such, they became or attached themselves to the house of Israel. Now, they maintained their separate dwellings and families in Israel's history. You may recall in 1 Samuel chapter 15, when God gave commandment through Samuel the prophet to Saul to utterly destroy the Amalekites. At that time, he was instructed to make sure that the Kenites were spared. So in verse 6 of 1 Samuel 15, Saul said unto the Kenites, "Go depart, get you down from among the Amalekites, lest I destroy you with them. For you showed kindness to all the children of Israel when they came up out of Egypt." So the Kenites departed from among the Amalekites. So we can see that they were still there with the children of Israel there into the time of King Saul. And they were rewarded there by God for their the goodness, the kindness that they had shown to the Israelites going back to the time in the wilderness when Jethro came to them and helped them. But they had continued to follow the Lord through all those years, and they're still there, and they're still serving God, and God rewarded them and spared them. It's interesting that when Jehu is choosing someone to assist him in the destruction of the house of Baal, he's taking one of the Kenites, Jonadab, who was the son of Rechab. So he's one of those. He's a Rechabite. He's of this family of the Kenites. It's interesting to see, to trace the history of that, those people in Israel. And what we see with every mention with one exception that I'm aware of, and that would be the exception of Jael's husband that had separated himself from his family because he wasn't following God and joined himself with the Canaanite kings. And he was one when Deborah was judge of Israel, going back to Judges chapter 4. He was involved in assisting those Gentile Canaanites under Jabin and Sisera, their captain, against the Israelites. But he was a notable exception and had removed himself from his family in his evil. So with that exception, other than that, but what we read about the Kenites and the Rechabites as a people, they were faithful servants of the Lord through all the years from the time going back to the wilderness when they joined themselves to the Israelites and turned to serve God. They continued that through all those years. And all those times when the Israelites themselves became unfaithful and turned away from Jehovah, we see the Kenites still there serving God and much better than the ones who were the actual physical descendants of Abraham, the Israelites themselves. So we see one of them being a chief one that Jehu is using to destroy Baal worship here on this occasion. He brings Jehonadab with him to do this work. So here's a man that's truly zealous for Jehovah and against this false worship. But isn't it interesting? It's not an actual Israelite that's with Jehu to do this. Want to just mention before we close, in Jeremiah chapter 33, if you want to read that, that's much later in the future. But this is goes to the time near the end of the kingdom of Judah, when they had turned away from the Lord, forsaken him, and gone after all of those idols. And it was on the eve of their destruction, with only a remnant to be preserved in Babylon. But who does the Lord use to shame Israel as an example of faithfulness to his covenant in spite of all of them? The Rechabites in Jeremiah 33. So even all the way into the future after this time, we're going to see how the Lord uses them, the same people that Jehonadab was a member of, as an example of being faithful to God's covenant. And God was going to uphold them and does uphold them as an example of faithfulness to God and to his covenant through all of their generations. So that's a very good history to trace in terms of seeing how they followed the Lord for centuries through all of the ups and downs and the cycles of rebellion against God that occurred so much by the Israelites themselves. But here was this one group or family that was faithful to the Lord through it all, like we need to be. So we'll try to go through that a bit more at the beginning of our time next Lord's Day. But we're out of time now, so we'll stop for this moment. But go ahead and take an opportunity as the Lord gives you this over this next week or this week, as he wills. But take that any opportunity there to read Jeremiah 33 and to refresh on these Rechabites, and because this is one of them we're reading about. Much before Jeremiah's time, but still we see that same faithfulness and devotion to serving the Lord there with Jehonadab. We'll stop now, and let's close with going to our Heavenly Father in prayer again.